right, Decisions from Outer National. Once again, that always just fires me up. Just fires me up. Ready to go in, jump in. And we got to start thinking about making some decisions. People got to start deciding about what the hell they're going to do in the face of this horror that we're living under. The entire planet stands in danger of total destruction. Human beings stand in danger of total destruction. And all of the various animals and other creatures. In other words, the entire planet stands in the danger of, boom, it's gone. Or, whew, it's dead. That's what we're up against. And this show, and me in particular, I'm going to not go down quietly, all right? And I hope you aren't either. And if I know most of my people that listen to my show, I know you're not going to go down quiet. So what we're going to talk about today, at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Nora Benavides, Director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at PEN America, and she's going to join us to talk about the L.A. Press Freedom Week. And it's a very interesting thing because it really digs into a lot of sort of what we're allowed to know, why we're not allowed to know it, and how journalists are standing up very, very courageously against all this. And before that, we'll be hearing a special piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on the destruction of the planet by capitalism and imperialism. And opening the show up is someone I'm really happy to have him back. It's been, I don't know, I think he was about 3 and I was about 1 the last time he was on the show. And it's always good to have him back and to finally get back in touch with him. Josh Willis. Josh is the lead scientist for NASA's OMG Oceans Melting Greenland on the rapid melting of glaciers and the consequences. That's what we're going to be talking about. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, definitely, man. We got a lot to chew on because so much is happening. It's just, it's mind-boggling. And I'm going to open up, but I want to also let you know that wherever you feel you have to go on much longer and whatever else, do so, please, because this is one of the most important things I think that people can actually, do these days in terms of just to understand what's going on. And then on that basis, be able to take some action against all this or try and attempt to at least try and save one little corner of this globe for humanity and the animals and everybody else. All right, so let's dig into it. You've just come back from a cruise off of the coast of Greenland. And I know the last... go ahead.
A flight, actually. We flew around Greenland in an old, well, not so old anymore, DC-3 built for World War II and outfitted for science just a couple years ago. But we flew all the way around the edge of Greenland, looking at the oceans and also seeing the ice as it was melting this year.
Wow. That's interesting because I've always thought that you were actually going out there in a boat and you were sort of like, with a pitchfork and sort of jamming at the ice to see where it's loose and what's going on. Because it's sort of that's what you expect. But then actually this is what you're saying, it does. It's interesting because it does give you a bigger overall picture. And what are you seeing here now?
Well, Greenland had an incredibly warm year. It was a record melt at the surface. It's a massive island. You have to remember Greenland is just this gigantic area, and it's almost all covered by ice. 2 miles thick in the center, the ice is just this incredible, enormous part of the landscape. And this year, it had an incredibly warm heat wave move over the ice sheet. The air had record temperatures in a lot of places across Greenland for a lot of days, and there was just a massive melting event. And you could see it all around the edges where this water from the melted ice ran off into the oceans, created these gigantic rivers of meltwater that plowed through the small communities around the edges and also helped to eat away the ice right at the edge where the glaciers meet the oceans.
Hmm. Well, tell me this, like when you're talking about ice loss, I don't know if people, it's one thing for people who have studied this or who have paid attention to it to some degree, but I think it's actually, I was talking to somebody the other day and they were sort of dumbfounded when I was talking to them about like the Greenland's ice loss and what it's going to mean for the world. You know, and I thought that was really, really kind of, well, one, it was a sort of a kick in the gut because you're sort of thinking, okay, here's somebody who knows a lot about generally about, you know, what's happening in the world, but doesn't understand this. And I was curious as to how you actually speak to this in terms of the ocean's role in what's happening with, you know, because people think, okay, if they're losing ice, it's just like, you know, look, if you live in New York, it snows, you get ice on the street, and then, you know, it's it melts. And if you live in Chicago, it snows, you get ice on the street, and people freeze. But it's sort of, you don't have a whole lot of, you know, understanding of what difference does it make to have this kind of ice loss, and what role is, you know, the ocean playing in this?
Yeah, you know, we think of Greenland as a big ice cube with a hairdryer on it, right? The warm air is just melting it from the top, and that's happening. But also the ice runs off of the land into the ocean. So there's so much ice there, and it's so big that it doesn't act like a solid, like an ice cube. It acts like a liquid, and the ice literally flows off of the land into the ocean in these ice streams that we call glaciers. That's literally what a glacier is. It's a big river of moving ice. And the ice sheet is constantly dumping ice into the ocean. But what's happening now is that as the water warms up, it starts to melt away at the edge of the glacier. And it causes the glacier to retreat, moving back up into the canyons and valleys that they're formed in. This causes the glaciers to speed up and dump more ice into the ocean. And the whole thing just accelerates the speed at which we can, the speed at which Greenland is losing ice and causing sea level rise. So we're not just seeing Greenland melt from a warm air, a warm atmosphere. It's also melting because the ocean is eating away at the edges of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I was laughing about this when I first, because it's been a while since we've talked, and I actually was remembering this OMG that's behind your name all the time. And, right. You know, it's really, it captures something though, because, you know, people are looking at it like, and they're like, it's, oh my God, or it's, what's going on? But it's actually, there is something that's concentrated in this. It's a very simple little expression, but it actually concentrates a lot of where other people's heads should be.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, it's the basic idea of our whole experiment that the oceans are melting Greenland, OMG. So it's a reminder that it's sort of shocking how fast our world is changing and that this gigantic ice sheet that is way up there in the northern hemisphere is melting and causing sea level rise all around the world. So, yeah, I chose that name carefully because I wanted people to remember it, not just because it's a, you know, kind of a funny play on words, but because that's really what's happening. The oceans are melting away the ice.
Mm-hmm. You know, and you were talking about earlier, just earlier, but the, you know, that's exactly it, the ocean's role in Greenland's ice loss. And I think a lot of people find that very, very difficult to understand because they're sort of thinking like, look, it's cold in Greenland. What? No, I mean, you know, this, it's unfortunately we live in a country where science is not sort of really, you know, admired by the vast majority of people. Not that people wouldn't want to, you know, understand science and understand the world, but actually that the way we're sort of raised and taught and everything is actually, you know, if you're into science, you're really barely able to speak to human beings and you're just buried in books. And, you know, I mean, that's serious. You know, I got a degree in biology and I know that's what people, you know, always thought, okay, that's what you're going to do. That's what, you know, but they never, ever questioned why I was interested in that or what. And I wasn't interested to go on being a biologist myself, but I was interested in how the world was working. And there's a certain import to that. There's a certain importance to that, I think, in relation to everything we're talking about, because if you can look at what's happening and not, you know, be pretty damn upset, you got to figure out what is it that you're thinking? What's the way that you're thinking? What's wrong with the way you're thinking?
Right. I mean, I think there's an enormous value in just having curiosity about the world. I mean, it's what drove me to get a PhD and study how the planet's changing, because I wanted to learn things about the world that nobody knew before. And that's kind of what we're doing with OMG. This year, we had a really exceptional survey, and we collected data in a bunch of places where we never were able to get to before, in part because they were covered with ice in the past. And we also saw some really surprising things. So when the meltwater at the surface, when you have a really warm year like this, the meltwater at the surface, it doesn't just run off the top of the ice into the ocean. It actually drills holes down through the ice sheet, and the water makes it all the way down to the bedrock below the ice. And then it runs out toward the ocean underneath the ice. And this means that when it reaches the water, when it reaches the ocean, it's very fresh because it's melted ice, and the seawater is very salty because it's the ocean. And that water rises along the face of the glacier in what's called a plume. And for the first time ever in our experiments, we flew past some glaciers where the plume was visible at the surface, where this meltwater coming out from under the glacier was so strong that it rose all the way to the surface and made this kind of churning, bubbling cauldron of water right at the glacier's edge. And we were able to sample these with our ocean instruments for the first time ever in our mission and get a look at how the ocean and ice are interacting right there at the edge.
And when you do that, I mean, when you're talking about this, I keep thinking too again how much science is kept away from people generally here. And I keep thinking about that, you know, there's an overall assessment of that you're making, that you've made and that you've written and stuff, that an overall assessment of that there are things that, you know, that are going on, you know, and in fact, one of them is globally that the fact that 8 of 10 of the warmest years since 1860 were in the past decade. And what does that mean? I mean, if you're looking at something that's concentrated like that, and it's sort of like, you know, okay, a little while ago, you know, 1860, okay, in major time, that's not that long ago, but you're looking at like, okay, what is it that did this, that turned this around? What is it that turned things from, and what would be the upshot of actually all of this happening where people do not see or refuse to see what's going on, or it's being kept from people. And the fact that that basically an overall assessment of where things are at these days is pretty damn gloomy. I mean, with eight of 10 of the warmest years since 1860, we're in the past decade alone.
Yeah. Well, there's no question that the planet is heating up very rapidly and that it's caused by human activity, that our burning of fossil fuels is warming up the planet. That's not in doubt. It's definitely happening. And the impacts are huge. I mean, there's enough ice in Greenland to raise sea levels by 25 feet. Now, right now, it's only melting at a rate that raises sea levels by less than a millimeter every year. But as the planet warms up, these things can run away more and more quickly. And so that's why what we're doing with OMG is really important. We're trying to figure out, how fast can this ice really disappear, and how much sea level rise are we going to get because of it in the next few decades and then the next 100 years? And every time we make a discovery, we find out that the ice is more threatened than we thought before. It's more at risk, and we're always revising our estimates of sea level rise upward because of that. You know, and another thing you mentioned was kind of communicating this stuff to the public. I take a very, you know, great responsibility myself personally to try and communicate what I'm doing and the science that I'm doing to as broad an audience as possible. And it's one reason I run a Facebook page and an Instagram account and a Twitter account, because I think people ought to know exactly what we're finding out.
Yeah, it's extremely important. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Josh Willis, lead scientist for NASA's OMG, Oceans Melting Greenland. And we're talking about the rapid melting of glaciers and the consequences for all of us and for the planet. You know, Josh, one of the things that I keep thinking too is when we talk about it being fast, and a lot of people will say, I mean, look, there's a lot of simple-minded things going that are being passed off to people, and people just grab them because all these things have always, and again, I know I sound like I'm going to jag about this, but it really irritates the hell out of me that, you know, we have We have people like you who understand all this stuff. We have people who want to understand all this stuff and never get the chance to do that. Where actually, in a lot of ways, people who are scientists, and I think there's actually an important movement going on in terms of a lot of scientists really trying to figure out the ways that they can actually reach, you know, basic people and talk with them about what's going on with this. And I think it's really, really imperative that we figure out how to bring that together so people can actually understand what's happening and what the consequences of not paying attention is.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, I think as a scientist, we have a responsibility to people to explain what we're doing, not just to other scientists, but to people in general. And as a climate scientist, I feel that even more because these changes are happening right now to our planet. And there's a big question about what the future is going to be like. And on top of that, there's a decision we have to make. I mean, you know, we know why the planet's warming up. It's warming up because we're burning fossil fuels and putting extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And we have to make a decision about how long we want to let that go on and how much carbon we want to put in the atmosphere. And it's not an easy decision. Look, I mean, our economy was built on doing this. And switching the economy to a new fuel source is not easy. But it's a choice we kind of have to all consciously make together. And, you know, I have to say, personally, I think it's not one that you can fix just by, you know, driving a hybrid car or planting a tree. We really have to fix it at the highest levels of government, too. We really have to get our governments to address it. We can't do it all alone by ourselves as individuals.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you say this, because I was thinking about what's been going on in the various international meetings that have been held over the last couple of, the last couple of weeks, and the kinds of things that are being put out there, and how here, we, you know, there's this... if there's ever a place that's going to act stupid, it's going to be, you know, here. And and it's sort of like, you know, one of the things that you see, and part of it has to do with, I mean, we have people in office who are just like rubbing their hands and chuckling over being able to destroy, you know, pieces of the, you know, sections of this country that they're just waiting to get in there and get whatever's underneath that soil, tear places apart so that this becomes something out of a horrifying, you know, whatever, you know, some kind of whacked out horrifying music, horror film. You know, you're looking at this.
It's like pirate treasure, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah. Yeah. So what do we, you know, here's the thing. It's like we talked about this. Okay, how bad it is. It's moving fast. You know, the excess heat in the ocean and where we're at. I wanted to talk about this. Did you find a lot more melting ice this trip?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was clear from all kinds of signs just how warm a year they had in Greenland. The atmosphere was had record high temperatures in a whole lot of places and a lot of hot days. So in Greenland, you know, you count the number of days above zero and that kind of tells you how much melting there is. And they had a lot of warm days all over the ice sheet. And the runoff from this was enormous. So there was an enormous amount of melted water that flowed off of the ice into sea level and into the oceans and will raise sea level by a measurable amount just from this summer alone. Now, there's another part to this, though, which is what the oceans are doing. And the oceans this year were actually not the record warm temperatures, at least on the west coast of Greenland, where a lot of the action is. You know, we have these natural cycles in the ocean that bring warm water or cool water for several years to the west coast of Greenland. And a few years ago, we saw a shift from warm to cool. Now, we know in the long run that this is going to warm back up because it's part of a natural cycle. But this year, that didn't happen quite yet. So, you know, one way to look at it is that as much warming as there was at the surface, it could have been a lot worse. Because the ocean hasn't warmed back up yet. So this is actually really important for the scientists like me because it helps us separate how much melting is caused by the air versus how much melting is caused by the oceans. So this year, we're going to be looking at very carefully for a long time because we had a warm atmosphere and a cold ocean. And, you know, in the past, we've had both be warm. And so we're it's helping us kind of separate out just how important the ocean is going to be. And that's a big deal, because if the ice sheet is going to disappear rapidly, it's going to be because of the oceans.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with scientist Josh Willis, lead scientist for NASA's OMG, Oceans Melting Greenland. So pay attention, folks, because this is deadly serious stuff, and it's important that people actually understand what's going on, because you can't do anything about it if you don't have some kind of understanding of this. Which leads me to this next thing, Josh, because, you know, it's really, you're looking at this and you're thinking about, you know, it's sometimes it's just things get so simple, but they're so, you know, amazingly complex and just smacking you in the head. There was a way that this was put about, if you listen to Arctic glaciers, that you can actually hear the sounds of bubbles bursting. And what that means in terms of, you know, I mean, I imagine if you're, if somebody like you, if I'm out there and it's bubbles bursting, I'm kind of like, oh, wow, bubbles bursting. But if you're out there, what is that saying to you about what's happening now?
Well, look, I mean, it's a, you know, we're watching an uncontrolled experiment play out in our planet's climate. You know, we have this change that we're witnessing that's never happened before in human history. So every year we learn about how the change is playing out, and in a way that's the scariest part, because it means there's a whole bunch we don't know about what's going to happen. Now, that said, I don't want to make it sound like we have no idea what's happening. The planet's definitely warming up. Sea levels are rising. Storms are getting more intense. Floods are getting more frequent along the coastlines all across the planet. All these things are happening. Heat waves are becoming more intense and more frequent. So we're watching our planet change. And I think, to me, the scariest part is we keep getting surprised. We keep finding out new ways that the planet's changing that we had no idea about before. And it's only a matter of time before some of those start to bite us in a really big way.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you say that, I was thinking about something you had said, and it's in relation to this point about I think it was you that said this: as the oceans go, so goes the climate. Or maybe it was somewhere else I saw that, but it was in relation to what we're talking about. As the ocean goes, so goes the climate. And I kept thinking about that in relation to this thing, which you did speak about, which is, and you were starting to speak about now, about the sound of bubbles bursting in Arctic glaciers and how that's a measure of how fast glaciers are melting.
Yeah. So we keep finding new ways to figure out how the climate's changing radically. That's exactly right about the ocean. I mean, you got to remember the ocean covers two-thirds of the planet, more than two-thirds of the planet, and it's really the driver for how our planet's climate changes. You know, you can think of the ocean as sort of like a potato in the oven, and the atmosphere is like a piece of aluminum foil wrapped around that potato. You know, if the aluminum foil is sitting in the oven and it's 400 degrees and it's just all by itself, you can reach in and grab the aluminum foil because it doesn't contain a whole lot of heat. But if you wrap it around a hot potato and pick it up, you're going to burn yourself. And the ocean is kind of like the climate's potato. It's really the driver for our entire climate. Over 90% of the heat that's trapped by these greenhouse gases is actually warming the oceans. So even though the air is warming, really all the action's in the oceans.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more question here, and maybe two. The impact of a changing climate. You know, a lot of times, I keep coming back to this thing of hearing too many people saying, oh, come on, you know, you put a coat on, or look, you're living in the beach now. You know, it's sort of all this kind of just flippant stuff about what is actually happening. And it's even more, it's worse than what I'm saying. I'm just throwing that out to get through that. But it's actually, when you talk about the impact of a changing climate, and this really sort of really grabbed me when I was reading it in something you were writing about, and it talks about the Arctic on fire and 1 million species facing extinction. You know, when you have something like that being caused by, in relation to, this changing climate, it should make one at least step back a couple miles and figure out what the hell's going on here. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not even that far away. You know, you're talking about the Arctic or a bunch of species that maybe people don't see every day, right? But the fact is that the Pacific Coast Highway right here in California is threatened in a bunch of places by sea level rise. We have nuclear power plants up and down our coast that are going to have to deal with it. The port of L.A. and Long Beach, naval bases all around the country, all this infrastructure is threatened by sea level rise. And we know it's rising, and we know it's going to keep rising, but we don't know how fast. There's already communities along the coastline in California that are struggling to figure out whether they should be, you know, building seawalls or moving away and abandoning these towns. So there's impacts that are happening right here, right now already, and they're caused by human-driven climate change. And so we're already dealing with it.
Boy, one more question. The March for Science is coming up September 20th. I know you were really big into the last one that happened a while back, and or the first one that was actually came out. What are you thinking about in relation to this March for Science?
Well, I think it's great. I mean, I think, you know, it's incredibly important for people to understand the purpose of science and to support it. I mean, you know, science is about learning how the world works. And, you know, think about what it means to not want to know how the world works.
Yeah.
I mean, just think about that for a second. How could you not want to know what's going on in the world and why it's happening? So I think it's fantastic for people to show up in support of science. I think what's sad is that science feels so attacked that we have to do this.
Mm, good point. Very good point. All right, man. Anything else you'd like to leave us with?
Sure. I mean, if you're interested in learning more about OMG, you can find me on Facebook as Climate Elvis or on Twitter and Instagram at OMG NASA. These are personal pages that I use to tell people about the science we're doing, and I hope you'll check it out.
All right. Just say those two again. So,
you bet. Facebook.com/ClimateElvis, because I kind of look like Elvis. And also on Twitter and Instagram, it's at OMGNASA.
All right. And, you know, I just want to remind you, I think that was the last time you were on the show. You came in with your Elvis costume on. Okay, I'll never forget it.
It's never far from my heart.
There you go.
It's never far from my heart.
All right, Josh. Thank you very much, and I'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Thank you so much. Sure. Take care, Michael.
Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and there's something else that I wanted to add on here in relation to all this. Later this month, there's going to be worldwide actions for the climate. The global climate strike, September 20th to 27th. There are major actions on the 20th and 27th, and shut down D.C. on September 23rd. You can go to globalclimatestrike.net or just go to my Facebook page, or now you can also check Sting's Facebook page, okay, and get all the information you need. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Keep on flying. You can break my heart.
right, welcome back. I have a couple of announcements I want to make before we get into this next segment. All right, and one is to announce, to let people know that there's a mass meeting to consider and plan sustained nonviolent mass resistance, mass protest beginning in October. And this is a meeting that's happening Sunday, September 22nd, and it's at 11 a.m. at Steinbrook Center, which is at 1226 Vermont Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. Oh, you're not going to be there. Okay. But you can know that it's going on. All right. Really, people are going to be getting together to consider and plan for a sustained nonviolent mass protest beginning this October. As I said, Puerto Rico and Hong Kong show the way, thousands becoming millions. All right. And this is actually something I think is extremely important for people to follow up on and think about how you're going to get how things are going to be spreading around about this, all right, how things are going to be spreading around. Because you know what? The entire planet could disappear. You know, the entire planet, all everything in it could just go. That's it. Just an empty hot rock. Okay. That's what we'd have. All right. So now I wanted to bring this up because this is one of my, I think this is most fitting for what we've been doing. And I think it's one of the most important things I do try to do each week, which is to bring something from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And today I want to bring this, which is the destruction of the planet by capitalism, imperialism. And it's from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And it fits very well with what we've been talking about. So check this out.
The destruction of the planet by capitalism, imperialism. The very fact that global warming is one of the major reasons why there are today a greater number of refugees, 65 million, than at any time since World War II, is one powerful indicator of the severity of the climate crisis, which is increasing in intensity at an accelerating rate. The scientific evidence is overwhelming. The climate crisis poses a very real and growing threat to human civilization. And human activity, in particular the production and use of oil and other fossil fuels, is a major cause of this intensifying crisis. The accelerated melting of the ice sheets in Antarctica, the destruction of vast expanses of rainforests, the despoiling of other key parts of the Earth, including the oceans, with the terrible consequences for plant and animal species, which are also vital for human existence. All this can only continue and even further accelerate with human society under the domination of the capitalist imperialist system. Despite conferences and agreements which claim to be addressing this crisis, but which are dominated by the countries that are the biggest contributors to this crisis, despite talk and even some steps to develop sources of energy as alternatives to fossil fuels, despite all this, the very nature of the capitalist imperialist system dictates that competing capitalists controlling billions of dollars of investments, and the governments of the major world powers in particular, are compelled to contend with each other for markets, cheap labor and raw materials, including fossil fuels, and for control of strategic parts of the world. This leads not only to economic and political conflicts, but repeatedly to wars, which themselves have a devastating effect on the environment. And it is worth noting that the U.S. military is the single largest institutional consumer of oil in the world. To make matters even worse, this system has now brought forth a fascist regime to power in the U.S., which is determined to shatter agreements and roll back regulations that offer even minor, if completely insufficient, protections for the environment, and to unleash forces whose effect on the environment, if persisted in, could actually lead to the destruction of human civilization. Obviously, we have only one Earth as a home for humanity, and this climate crisis can only be fundamentally and ultimately addressed on a world scale. But a first great step, or leap, can be taken by wresting power from the capitalist imperialist system in its most powerful stronghold, and making this a source of inspiration and base of support for people around the world in rising up to overthrow and abolish all systems and relations of exploitation, oppression, plunder, and destruction of the environment and of human beings who can only continue to exist and to thrive through a rational and planned interaction with the rest of nature. From all this, it stands out very sharply that we live in a grossly lopsided world, a world where a few dozen billionaires have as much wealth as the poorer half of humanity, and a small number of ruling classes in a small number of countries dominate, oppress, and control the destiny of the masses of humanity, with consequences that are already terrible and could, before long, become catastrophic. And in everything that I've been shining a light on regarding the world we live in under the domination of capitalism, imperialism, we are seeing the consequences of a system based on the private appropriation by competing centers of capital of wealth that is socially produced through networks of production involving vast numbers, ultimately billions of people all over the globe, who are forced now to work in conditions and relations of production that exploit and dehumanize them. It is not simply greed that drives these capitalists to constantly seek ways to more ruthlessly exploit people. It is the fact that if they do not do this, or if some other capitalists do it more successfully, that is, even more ruthlessly, then they will face the prospect of not just falling behind, but actually going under, eaten up by other capitalist sharks. It is the private appropriation of socially produced wealth and the anarchy, the feverish competition and contention that results from this, which ultimately underlies and drives all the horrors that are concentrated in the five stops and the conditions to which the masses of humanity are continually subjected. The solution is to replace this system of private appropriation with a system where the socially produced wealth is also socially appropriated by a government actually representing the masses of people instead of a class of capitalist exploiters. And this wealth is then utilized on the basis of conscious planning in the interests and for the benefit of the people of society and ultimately the whole world. How this can be done is spelled out in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. This is the fundamental difference between the society and world we have with the system of capitalism and imperialism that we are forced to live under and the world we could have. The bridge between these two worlds is revolution, a real revolution. Let's be honest. This is a difficult road, but there is no other way to finally put an end to the horrors that are continually brought forth by this system. And as hard as this is, it is possible if we go about it the right way, with the right outlook and approach, the right goals and methods, the right strategy and plan. So this is what I'm going to dig into through the course of this talk.
All right, well, that was Bob Abakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the piece was The Destruction of the Planet by Capitalism and Imperialism, and it's taken from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. You can find that and much more from Abakian on revcom.us. We're going to take a very, very short break and bring on our next guest, who I'm really anxious to talk to, so let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
I might just break the chain. some of that, especially where we from. Where we grew up like a green thumb, like a criminal, the only thing you can become. Look at what I became, something like a phenom, nothing but a G-thang. Things I've seen when I'm looking out of these frames, pictures I painted on the walls where we hang. From the trees we hung, strange fruit man, look at how we swung. How the hell you gonna tell a son who ain't have a father how to try to grow up and be one? See, feel it in my bones and I'm sitting on the throne like a killer with the chrome when I'm spitting out the poem. Shed a whole lot of light on a little bit of home. Bam.
Thought I was MIA, no paper planes. I'm flying, plus I don't write no more. Cause all up on the top, I shave the brains to stay sharp. Man, I knew how to raise a blade. I paid my dues, now I wait for change. Look at the flow so rude, it goes without Snoopy. I'm Sucre, I ate the break. Quick to cut off any baggage like some samurai. I like to travel light. I'm gonna leave you at home, Delilah. This is Samsonite. No case for the police, said no killers, I never seen them. Ghost face on the top, I'm watching this my panorama. I got an alibi, I must take a pic of Chicago. Call me camera shy.
I'm a plane, yo. Snatch your hair and bones from the game, though. Put it on mine, took a long time. B.A. Baracus, how I'm looking online. In the web of soul, necklace stole. Let them know that I put up the footage that I'm taking your shine. Wanna see the real change, look in your mind. Your brain look like Kenny Wayne, brother. Overgo, overload, broken soul. Niggas playing games in the hood, they got you, sucker. Play a thing, it's cool to be a pimp still. We gon' set it free like fish in a pimp pill. Take this soul and rearrange it, change it.
You know, this is a scene where actually we're really looking at that, some very dangerous stuff going on in the world right now. And I was really pleased, actually, to run across this, my next guest. And I was looking for something to talk about, talk with people about. And I was sent some information by the PEN America. And it's about LA Press Freedom Week. And I want to welcome to the show. I'm someone who, as I said, I'm really, really pleased to be talking with. Her name is Nora Benavides. She's the director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at PEN America. And she's joining us to talk about the LA Press Freedom Week. Nora, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's great to be here.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this because we got a clicking clock. And I have so much to ask you. I've got 17 pages of questions, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. What is LA Press Freedom Week?
Sure. Well, you know, it's actually going to be our first ever LA Press Freedom Week. It kicks off next Monday, September 16th. And we're working with partners like the Committee to Protect Journalists, for example, Reporters Committee for Journalists, for the Protection of Journalists. And it's going to be an opportunity to have various discussions over the course of the week that bring together media freedom advocates, journalists, lawyers, and frankly, just other supporters to celebrate press freedom and the First Amendment. And I think it's really great that it's happening in L.A. You know, L.A. is our entertainment capital of the world. It's a global city. It's really a perfect place to rally the media around the importance of storytelling and how stories shape how we think about our communities. I think that sometimes terms like press freedom can seem like an abstract concept. And part of what we're trying to do is make real for people throughout the programs next week how press freedom really does affect our daily lives and why the First Amendment is actually so important right now. So, you know, just to give you a very small teaser of some things, you know, from elections and the challenges that reporters face when covering elections to questions around how the news gets made, how diversity in the media plays a role in the news. We're hoping to just spotlight all of the ways that journalism is more important than ever.
Mm-hmm. Just let me fill people in on this for a minute. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. You know, I was thinking about this actually as I was reading some of the stuff coming out from your group. You know, it's interesting because the attacks on progressive journalism, and whether it's radio, whether it's print journalism, whatever it is actually they're increasing. They're deadly. I mean, not just to the journalist and journalism, but when you think about what actually happens to some of these people, I was thinking in particular of some of the people that have been locked up on the border, and how that nobody knows what or knew what, and still we don't know that much, but nobody knew anything about what was happening to these people, what was happening to the children, what was happening to the adults, where were they going? What just disappeared, and it was only because of the courage and fortitude of the press to actually push ahead on this and not let it go. Sort of okay, well, we don't know, and we'll just rely on the system to actually work things out, because it was a very deadly circumstance. And I thought that was really, you know, that was really something that was very important and really should wake people up in relation to the importance of a fearless press, and a fearless press that's actually trying to make a good impact in the world, you know, to actually change things in a way that human beings can live in the world.
Absolutely. And I felt like, you know, in PEN America coming on to host an event, which I know we'll talk about, We just felt like we couldn't miss this opportunity to spotlight what is going on at the border, and that but for journalists risking their lives to try to cover what is happening, whether it's at detention centers or actually on the border itself, we just had to tell those stories because they're not only are they compelling, but I think they're ones that the public has to know about, and otherwise they wouldn't know about any of this.
Mm-hmm. What about assaults on journalists? You know, what have you seen around that, and how does it express itself in relation to when they're there and they put their careers and their lives on the line in order to expose what's happening to immigrants, like I was talking about earlier? You know, that basically, and it's not only because of them that we know of what actually is happening to immigrants, but there's also a lot that these people put on the line in order to make that possible.
Well, I would love nothing more than to work myself out of a job one day, but we are in the terrible predicament that we are in now, where I think, you know, assaults on journalists and anyone, frankly, critical now of the administration is very urgent. And we're seeing things, I mean, think back to, you know, the shooting at the Capital News Gazette in Maryland. That was sort of one of the early examples where we saw threats to journalists increasing. Where the border is concerned, though, we are seeing there have been many, many months of news coverage showing that what's happening is human rights advocates, journalists, are being targeted and detained in relation to their immigration work and on their attempts to report on issues around the border. And so we've been tracking that and tracking the stories where journalists are either detained at the Mexican border and their passports are being flagged, or there are instances in which Customs and Border Protection are monitoring individuals and have begun developing extensive files with personal information about many journalists who are either trying to photograph what is happening at the border or report on it in some other way.
Yeah, it's extremely important. I was reading some of that in one of the things that came along with the announcement of this event, and it is very, very heavy. I mean, it makes the point that the public is only aware of the horrific treatment of migrants because reporters have put their careers and sometimes their lives on the line to cover these stories. You know, and it's interesting because I was a journalist for aside from the radio show, I was actually a writer and I still am a writer, but, it's always, you hate saying I was a writer because it really puts it, you know, no, I am a writer. And and what happens is, you know, when I was down in Atlanta, when the black children were being murdered and no one could figure out what happened. And, you know, it was very heavy to me because I spent a lot of time in there in different projects talking to people, and people knew what happened. The fact is, though, that the people that knew what happened, most of the black people that were living in the projects, they never got a ear from anybody. You know, they knew it. They had an idea of what was going on. There was bat patrols that were formed where people could try and, you know, fend off anybody that came in and tried to grab any of these kids. And if you, I don't know if you remember this, but it was a horrendous thing where little children were being burnt at the stake. you know, and it was the Klan and all these other people. But nobody wanted to say anything. And when you tried to do it, they would shut you down. If they don't shut you down with, and I remember with me, if they didn't shut me down with, you know, just sort of like, oh, you know, cops coming up and bugging you or threatening you, then they would do it. They would make it so, well, there's nothing really. I remember I had this one piece that was really, really just incredibly powerful, where this woman, this young woman, she had two kids and she was telling me, and she lived in the projects, and she was telling me this about why she was so involved in fighting against the murder of the children there. And she said, look, you know, one of the things I learned a long time ago, and I decided I would never let them do this to me again. She said, I was a little kid and I was staying in this little town south of Atlanta. And she said, and I remember, you know, sitting there and I'm watching as a car comes up, and there was the whole downtown, all the white people were out there, and a car comes up with a black man and a woman in the car. And within minutes, the car was stopped. The woman was dragged out of the car. The man was dragged out of the car. And then he was summarily castrated, burnt, and hung up and nobody ever did anything. And when I wrote about this, and I had people backing, and this woman was actually, she was very, very intense about it, but these people, and it was really upsetting, because it was, you know, I thought, okay, one place I would get it published would be a black newspaper there that was very widespread throughout that part of the country. And they said, we can't do this. They would shut us down almost immediately. And I kept thinking, through the years, I've kept thinking about the horror that actually represents when people, so many people think we have a free press. And yet when things happen like that, it's not always that easy to tell the truth.
No, and I actually think it's amazing you mention Atlanta. I used to live and work in Atlanta, and I know so much about the child murders. I knew some of the lawyers that were on that team, actually. And I think part of what you're talking about is the role that journalists play in holding our government accountable and building a sense of trust and awareness for communities about what is actually going on in our society. And part of what we're seeing here with journalists trying to cover news at the border is that at every stage they are either being targeted, silenced, chilled, you know, monitored, or in fact barred altogether from being able to tell stories. And it's not just the media then and the individual reporters that suffer. It's really the public that can't know about what's happening in what I believe is an example of the government not wanting us to know what's going on. You know, there are these new tent courts that are being built around the border, and they're for the immigration courts and judges to be able to hold asylum hearings in absolute secrecy. And some of the judges' chambers are open to the media, but the larger courts themselves are closed to journalists, and they're closed to legal observers. And it creates this specter of fear where people don't know what's going on, and there's no way to know. And so it's really up to journalists to advocate for access to this. And I think it's frankly incumbent then on people like me and other advocates in this space to be able to talk about the threats, and that we really need to provide a kind of safety net for journalists to try to continue doing their jobs.
Mm-hmm. And it can't be overemphasized that actually the more people know about that, the more the journalists can actually be protected to a certain degree, even though when you're working in a system and particularly, you know, you look at what's happening in this country, you're talking about what's happening in Mexico, you know, journalists can disappear just as easy as anybody else. And the fact of telling the truth and is something that always puts a target on someone, but it is very important that people don't let that stop them and that people stand up and protect journalists.
Absolutely. And, you know, part of why we're so excited about LA Press Freedom Week is that it's an opportunity to open up and build awareness around why journalism is so important. And my hope is that people get excited about that, that, you know, when more people know about and sound the alarm on these threats, it actually does really, truly build consensus. It builds momentum. We recently at PEN America put out a petition actually trying to hold accountable the Department of Homeland Security for their privacy violations of journalists. And, you know, that amassed almost 70,000 signatures, I think. We're trying to just build as much awareness about these issues as possible. And it's always, I think, understated that the public and the public outcry does a lot. And the more that we can sort of sound the alarm, the better.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael.
Sure.
See you.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Nora Benavides, Director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at PEN America. She's joining us. She joined us to talk about L.A. Press Freedom Week. And basically, look, folks, this is a hell of a time to be alive, both in what it's posing to us and also the need to get out and do things around it. And I want to thank, and one of these things is I really want to thank everybody who listens to this show. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I want to thank my guests, Josh Willis and Nora Benavides. I'd also like to thank the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, production assistant, Jeff Pryor, engineer, Teddy Robinson. See you next week.
No walls or tanks, no nations, no nations.